Welcome back to Hoops H.
You got to make sure you press the right button, Chen. Have you pressed the right button?
Yes, David, I hit the right button. Okay, welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody.
Are you sure? Are we going? Are we going?
Yes, we are going. It is September 23rd, 2020. We are recording. This is our September monthly podcast, off-season podcast. I'm your host, Chad Sherwood.
Hey, Tytel's here. We can see him.
Joined by David Gage. Back with video again for the first time in four or five podcasts. John Tytel with us. And John Stalica, defunded by Kyle Lamb.
No, we defunded the Kyle Lamb show so we could help build a brand new spanking puppet bunker for 2020-21.
I got to be honest, that show never had a whole lot of funding. It had so little that the host never actually appeared on the show.
Well, it has about as much funding as we do on this show here, which is got some scrap paper and I've got some an old pen. Anyhow, this is our September show. We have just going to kind of go over some of the latest news and notes around college basketball. Going to talk a bit here about the delay of the start of the season, but we want to start off actually not on as high of a note, but on some sad news that we've had over the course of the past month. And we lost two great legends in college basketball, two great coaching legends in both Lute Olson and John Thompson in the last month here. And Mr. Tytel, you are an alum of Arizona, and you have been doing on the site here going to a lot of Georgetown games recently because you live right in that area. And I know you've had the last couple of years, you've been attending a lot of Georgetown games and writing about them. So you kind of have ties to both programs. So I want to kind of toss it over to you to start with your thoughts about both men.
Sure. I appreciate it. Very sad year for everyone on so many levels, but certainly for college basketball fans. Tragic to lose. I mean, they both had great long lives and many accomplishments, but the passing of Coach Thompson and Coach Olson. A couple of very brief stories. I met Coach Thompson a few times. I sat one row behind him at the NCAA tournament when it was in D.C. a couple of years ago. I met him at the Knight Commission for Intercollegiate Athletics meeting a couple of years ago. I would see him and sit a few seats down from him at many, many Georgetown games. Seemed like a super nice guy, and I've heard nothing but good stuff about him, and I wish that I had the chance to interview him before he passed, and sadly I didn't. As far as Coach Olson, the only time I met him was at a pep rally in New York City when the Cats were back east to play Louisville back in the Patino era in the preseason NIT game. Actually, it was a Jimmy V Classic, sorry. And he came in at the end of the pep rally to just give a little talk, and there was a bunch of Wildcats there, and so he needed a place to see everybody. So he tried to stand on a chair, and he reached out for help, and I grabbed him and helped him up, thinking, oh, my God, like if Lute Olson falls and kills himself on my watch, I'm never going to get out of this bar alive. Fortunately, he didn't, and I have some great photos of him standing over me and me going nuts because the Silver Fox is right there. And they both brought me a lot of great memories as a basketball fan and journalist during the past several decades. So. Condolences to their friends and family and loved ones, and their legacies will last a long time because they were both amazing.
Yeah, about John Thompson, I'm a little more familiar with him than Lute Olson, although I was certainly had a lot of respect for both of them. He was really important, not just to Georgetown. I think that's stating the obvious, but to college basketball in general. He was a main character or a main player at a time where in the late 70s and early 80s when it was becoming a national brand, when the Big East and ESPN sort of were bringing it from, you know, where basketball as a sport had always been big, but programs for the most part were regional. He kind of made Georgetown a national brand. I think he kind of made the Big East a national brand. And he was a big key player in – that part where the NCAA tournament was exploding and when college basketball was kind of exploding, you know, across the nation. I think he was really important to that. And he's someone that, I think that the sport needed him and maybe the country needed him in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, when you look around the day, we probably need someone like that today too. I'm sad he's gone.
Yeah, and you know, I've got to say, it's very rare that you could point to one game or one moment to say when you became such a huge fan of a game. I honestly, with college basketball, I could say that the moment I became so addicted and so such a big fan of college basketball was in the I believe it was the 1989 NCAA tournament, Georgetown 50, Princeton 49, that 116 game that just that game, it's a game I'll never forget. And it just, obviously he was the coach at Georgetown against Pete Carril coaching at Princeton. It was, taking a look at it here. They actually called it the game that saved March Madness. I don't know that it quite saved March Madness, but it was just one of the, probably after watching that game, I don't think I missed another game that entire NCAA tournament or any other NCAA tournament from since then. I don't think I've watched, I've watched them all as much as I can, as I can religiously.
By the same token, John Thompson Jr. has also given us some lighthearted moments. First of all, you have to go back to 1980 when Georgetown and Syracuse was a budding rivalry. And as Georgetown fans will tell you, the last game ever played at Manly Fieldhouse, a Georgetown victory where Thompson declared Manly Fieldhouse is officially closed. And then you have to go about 5 years later when St. John's and Georgetown were both number one and number two in the country.
Oh, the sweater game. Yep, it was brilliant.
St. John's had won the first game down in D.C., but just prior to warm-ups, this was about, I think, six or seven games where Carnesecca had been wearing a sweater on the sidelines because he had been coming off of either a cold or the flu himself. But Thompson had a sweater on underneath, and strangely enough, it did take a little bit of air out of the building. Loosened up his team, and before you knew it, Georgetown had won three straight games against the Johnnies, but ultimately failed to win the national title that year.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes of him was when he was, as I think we know and most of our audience knows, he was real protective of his team around the press. He didn't open the locker room to anyone, and he took a little bit of flack for that, especially because college basketball was trying to market itself. So they basically told the media, you want the locker room, go into the locker room. You wanted somebody on the phone, you got him in about 10 minutes or 5 minutes. But John Thompson, you know, kind of protected his team from that. And his response to a question about, like, well, don't you think this would help them become articulate? Like, wouldn't it be good for the players? Was, I know a lot of idiots that talk to the press and they're still not articulate, which I to this day, I love that.
Just quickly back on Lou Dolson, Ty Taliano and all of his success, if you start out in Iowa, I guess Long Beach State for a year, then in Iowa, then Arizona, only one conference tournament championship ever. Now, we won't put aside the Pac-12 didn't have conference tournaments for a lot of those years, but only one conference tournament championship. I mean, that's not that good, is he? Was he?
So that is partially his fault in that he, I think, was one of the big people in the voices against having a Pac-10 at the time tournament, mostly because he had a great team and he didn't want to run the risk that he would win the regular season title and then lose out in the conference tournament and stuff. So I think that was a calculated effort by him. I certainly wish he had more, but he didn't. And he had amazing recruiting classes and a relatively scandal-free program, I think, during an era where there was a lot of that at other places. And he's revered and beloved throughout Tucson, Arizona. So very few coaches, I think. As you said, he moved around to several different schools. But when you think of Tucson, with all respect to Coach Miller, it is Lou Dolson, who is the coach of Tucson.
Yeah, 25 years in Arizona. I think he spent about 10 years in Iowa before that. Only two postseason championships ever, that one Pac-10 conference tournament championship and whatever happened in 97. I think you remember that a little bit also. No NIT championships, David. No CBIs, no CITs, no ACAs.
Yeah.
But now both were great coaches. And as Ty Tell said, the star show, and we echo that, you know, our condolences to their families and their close friends, and they're both going to be missed greatly. Let's kind of switch gears here, though, because the breaking news here in the last week or so with college basketball has been that the NCAA did come out and set the official start date for the season. It is going to be November 25th, pushing it back about 10, 15 days, I think, maybe a little more than that. They cut down on the number of games that teams can play. I believe three games off the maximum season. Four games, and that assumes that you play a three-game exempt event. If you don't play in a three-game exempt event, you could have up to two games less than that. There's also not going to be any preseason exhibitions or scrimmages this year, so the first action we'll see from any schools will be on November 25th. So, David, let me start with you on that. What are your thoughts on this? That would end up being about a 2.5 week delay.
I'll start with the delay itself. I didn't have any real issue with it. I don't know where we're going to be on November 10th, and I don't know if we'll be any better or worse or on November 25th. Part of me, it's like most, like 90% of the sports aren't playing now, but a few are. We're seeing football played. They're not playing in bubbles. And my thinking is if you can play football safely with moving hundreds of people around literally because you've got the 70 players that travel, you've got the entire coaching staff, the entire support staff, the trainers, if they're being able to do that with at the rate that they are, while there have been cancellations, about 75 or 80% of it so far has gone off as scheduled. I'd like to think that we can play basketball in November. November 25th, I think the longer we wait, the safer it'll be. So I'm fine with that. What I wasn't a fan of was the decision to cut the number of games down. I understand that on the surface, while they play about two games a week, we're starting two games 2 weeks later. Let's lot four off the schedule to not overwork the players. But a lot of the – I mean, you got to keep in mind, basketball at the Division I level isn't quite – and this is the same for football. It isn't quite as simple as calling up a school and just agreeing to play them. There's contracts. If you've sold tickets, if you sold the game to television, there's a lot more in place. And sometimes – canceling a game or rescheduling a game is a lot more difficult than it would be at the high school level or at the country club sport or the Olympic sports or like the non-revenue sports. And for a lot of the schools that we follow all of them, but for the under the radar schools that were sort of relying on those games for money, especially those, out of conference bye games, to have some of those cut, or in some cases all of those cut, I think it creates problems. I think now you've got a lot of schools running around trying to figure out how they're going to alter their schedule, and sometimes it's not up to you. A school might call you and say, well, you're one of the teams that we've decided to lop off. Sorry. I think with so many schools, and it's not all of them, I know some of the AC schools in particular are not doing this, but with so many schools going into winter break after Thanksgiving and staying on break all the way until mid to late January, the four games could have easily been made up with nobody in class, even with the two-week start. I think while that would have been a hassle, it would have actually been far less of a hassle than what we're dealing with now, because if you've been paying attention, it's just been a madhouse. Florida and Florida State, I'm understanding they're having a hard time getting that game scheduled. It was supposed to be the season opener. A lot of under the radar schools that scheduled more bye games this year in the hopes of claiming some of the money that they didn't make during the NCAA tournament are suddenly being dropped from games that they were depending on, and that's hurting them. Having said that, though, we are going to have a season. I do believe that. It's better than no season. There was a time up until really a few weeks ago, I was wondering if we were even going to have one at all. But I do think it was a mistake to shorten the number of games, and I think it created a lot more problems than simply playing the full 30 starting 2 weeks later would have created.
Well, Salika, let me ask you this. I mean, we've kind of followed up on that point to begin with here. It's kind of this mass confusion now as well. We are normally, when we are sitting here in late September, schools are maybe one or two schools have an opening or two left in their schedules, but we are basically have our schedules locked in, and we know who you're going to play and when you're going to play it. The conference schedules are being redrawn and re-released. On top of that, everybody has to scramble. There's events that are being organized and trying to figure out where they're going to be. Have you ever seen, this is just mass confusion, isn't it?
Well, this is just in September. Wait till we get till December and January, and you're going to have potential postponements because of COVID-19. We'll probably get into this a little bit later, but the Metro Atlantic has actually come out with a plan for their 20 conference schedule, which is also going to include a buffer. I think the second to last week in the regular season.
The last week before the conference tournament is a makeup week for makeup games. Yeah, go ahead.
But I think to your point earlier, this is also a time of the year where you would have conference schedules for all the major conferences come into play. We begin to see the TV schedule populate. But I think as far as bubbles or whatever euphemism the NCAA wants to use for them, you're probably going to see a bunch of these events that are going to be either at the Wide World of Sports down in Orlando. I know Asheville, North Carolina is going to be one site because the Maui Invitational got moved there. Another one of our favorite sites, the Sanford Pentagon, now hosting Atlanta. So there are going to be all sorts of environments around the country that are going to be hosting games.
Just to clarify one thing, although most of the teams that were going to be going to Atlantis are going to the Sanford Pentagon, not all of them are, and it is not being run by the Battle for Atlantis people. So it is a separate event just involving majority of the same teams. I know Battle for Atlantis was out there on Twitter trying to clarify that it is not their event. They are technically postponed, and that's it for this year.
And I think there's also the Mohegan Sun, which is slated to – they normally host the Hall of Fame tip-off, but I think there's going to be additional games played there as well.
Ty, let me kind of ask you, Salika kind of hinted about the COVID postponements, the possibility of all kinds of games being postponed. What we are seeing there, and David mentioned you're getting 85 to 90% of the college football games that are being scheduled played, but – that means you're losing a lot of games. Today alone, it's Wednesday the 23rd as we record this, I believe either three or four college football games for this weekend were canceled because of teams having COVID. Among them, the Notre Dame game for this weekend was canceled. I believe yesterday or the day before, that game was canceled. And now South Florida, who played Notre Dame last week, has canceled their game because their players have COVID. They may have gotten it in the game against Notre Dame. So
Or vice versa.
But this is, how do you deal with this from a scheduling standpoint? Is this going to be just mass chaos all season where we're having games canceled and we're trying to squeeze in makeups for all the way until the tournament's announced?
I think that mass confusion is a very accurate adjective and description in terms of the reason that the bubbles have worked in the NHL and the NBA is because they spent a gazillion dollars and said, look, like the only way you get inside is by proving that you are healthy. And if you screw around inside, we're going to throw you out and not let you back in. And they take it very seriously. And it worked for the most part. I don't know if it was perfect, but for the most part. I don't know if that's feasible at the college level in any sport, much less basketball. I still think that baseball can work only because there's very few circumstances where you and your opponent are right in each other's faces within 6 feet. Basketball, I think the whole point of playing defense is to not be farther away than 6 feet from your guy at all times.
Socially distant defense, yeah. Come on.
I think if we're also talking about baseball trying to make up games, look at the St. Louis Cardinals and Milwaukee Brewers. They're going to have a 5-game series to end the regular season where it would normally be three. But the other kicker is St. Louis could also potentially play the Detroit Tigers twice on the – I guess the Monday afterwards, if
okay. Need arrives. Okay, we became MLB HD. Tytel, you want to take it from where you left off?
To conclude, I mean, I don't think we can do a bubble for college basketball, and therefore there's always a risk. And you just have to put in all the protocols and get all the medical advice and say, like, if one guy tests positive, does that mean you postpone the whole team for that day? Or do you kick him off for a week or 14 days and let the rest of the team play? And how much flexibility do you have? And I think Orlando's hosting like every tournament in November. And if it works, maybe that's going to become the norm. We'll see.
Well, but David, what if we have this situation here where suddenly three or four guys on a team that, well, the team plays a game, the next day, three, four, five guys test positive. We got to shut that team down. Maybe we got to shut down a team they just played. And it could be 2 weeks till any of these teams play again. Like you're seeing with a lot of – you saw in Major League Baseball, Salika mentioned the Cardinals. They got shut down for 10 or 12 days at one point. Is that what happens?
It is what happens. It's you know, what's been happening, whether, and again, like, it's kind of ripping through a lot of campuses right now and a lot of, and through a lot of athletic departments right now. But yeah, typically an individual will be out for 2 weeks, and even when they come back, they have to kind of pass a physical. And while they might be recovered, it might take them, like, getting over any injury a while before they're back up to 100%. Like, you don't just get the flu, get over it, and get out there and go for 4-hour practices and play a full 40 minutes. It could take you a while to get back. If a certain percentage of the team, I want to say it's like in basketball, the guidelines are going to be either 2 or 3 players get it at the same time, then the whole team is removed. The guidelines are probably going to be announced tomorrow. What's the day? The 22nd. So if you're watching this at any time after we record it, they may have already been announced. But
if you're watching before we record it, I'm impressed. Yeah.
I'm anticipating that it's going to be either 2 or 3 players that could get a whole basketball team sidelined.
Well, Stalika, so we may end up with teams that may schedule the full 26, 27 games, may play 18, 19 by the time the season's over and run out of time before the tournament.
I think the other question is, what do you do if there's a potentially false positive here? Do you give them a chance for another test within 24 to 48 hours?
Right. We're going to run to that as well. But Titel, let me ask you this here. If we end up with, I think the NCAA said, every team, if they want to qualify for the NCAA tournament, has to play a minimum of 13 games. Maximum of 27. How do we evaluate? How is the NCAA going to pick a field of 64 or 68 or whatever it's going to be in March, with some teams having played 27 games and some teams maybe playing 13 games and going 12-1, but against crappy competition?
Not easily is the short answer. I think they're going to have to dig deep into the metrics bag to see if they can crunch some numbers to figure out how a 12-1 team compares to a 20-5 team, because there is no easy answer. What'll be interesting is, like, definitely strength of schedule, I think, will have an impact, as well as the number of games. But, like, will head-to-head matter at all? And, like, if you get a guy injured, is a COVID injury, quote unquote, compared to like a sprained ankle injury, compared to I'm choosing not to play because I have an autoimmune disease injury? Like, there's so many factors that I don't think there's an easy way to measure it.
Yeah, and I wish our colleague Joby Forza was here. He is a metrics guru, but yeah. I believe one of the reasons that a lot of the metrics, such as his JNG rating or the BPI or whatever the net, whatever work is, that no, everybody doesn't play everybody like you do in a professional sport, but everybody probably plays somebody who played somebody probably like 3 steps removed. Everybody's played each other. If you end up with something like an Ivy League that only plays conference games only, you've got no way to evaluate them because they played 0 non-conference games. So the metrics won't even fix that problem.
And I'll throw another wild card out to you this year. How do you calculate home court advantage? Because you're not going to have big home crowds this year. Are you going to be pumping in crowd noise? How is this going to work?
Some schools might, but probably not. But that has been pointed out, like, that there needs to be, I think by the committee, by several committees, that there needs to be crossover. There needs to be out-of-conference games. Otherwise, the metrics are totally unreliable. I mean, if all anybody plays is their conference schedule, then you can't really compare one team to another outside of that.
Yeah, like, I mean, well, yeah, if you only play conference schedules in every conference and the first place team in the ACC loses 6 games, but the first place team in the SWAC goes undefeated, then the metrics are going to have the SWAC team as the number one team in the nation, I guarantee you.
Yeah, and as boring and as, you know, as much as some of these out-of-conference bye games want people to make, you know, to just go outside and bang their head on the sidewalk, that really is how the power ratings and the metrics start to take shape. I mean, if you take those out-of-conference games away and the crossover games away, the metrics are useless.
So it's going to be there's a solution that the ACC came up with, David. They said, let's let everybody in the field this year. Why not? Not for that reason. They did it because we missed a tournament last year. That was the reasoning. But why not let every single team in? We'll play a 357-team NCAA tournament.
Yeah, okay. So explaining why this is a bad idea is kind of like explaining why wearing shorts in Alaska in February is a bad idea. It's just, I think it's totally obvious. For starters, as it stands now, even with 68 teams, I think a lot of people look at the first four, maybe not us, well, definitely not us, but a lot of the general populace as NCAA tournament light at best. So what, I mean, if that's what the way they look at games that are one game or one round separated from the round of 64, how are they going to look at games at the round of 357 or 256 that are 2 and 3 rounds away? It wouldn't be an expansion of the NCAA tournament atmosphere that we know and love. It would be an expansion at best of the first four, and it probably wouldn't even be that. The other problem is they claimed to be doing this to help the small conferences out. Well, of the 22 under-the-radar conferences, yeah, it is 22. I should know that I'm on under-the-radar. How many of them do you think would get a team into the round of 64 if they first had to start in the round of 357? It would be almost none of them. I mean, maybe one or two would get that far. But one of the
things – you're going to eliminate all those small conference teams a lot earlier than they would have been eliminated under the current system. You're right.
And, yeah, one of the things is if you're the Northeast Conference, I'll use that one because it is the best one. It's the one we love the most. We don't play favorites, but except with the Northeast, is that the showcase of the conference tournament is a big deal because it gets them, in one sense, an automatic bid to the round of 64 or the play-in game, I guess, is on the line. So there's intrigue there. There's interest there. It's on ESPN. People are watching it because they know this team is going to the NCAA tournament as we know it. If suddenly everybody's in it, that goes away. So they sort of lose their showcase, and there's no way they're getting anybody anywhere close to the round of 64.
Now, one thing I wasn't clear on, would transitional teams have been involved? Let's not forget the Merrimack Warriors. They were in their first year of Division One last year. Ended up winning the Northeast regular season crown.
Yeah, I believe the proposal was to include them. I think it was everybody.
Yeah, other than a few teams are actually ineligible, so I don't know about that. But Tytel, what about just maybe a smaller expansion? What about instead of doing 68, we go up to maybe, what would it be, 96 for this year or something like this? Or is there anything here, or is it just maybe the ACC trying to find an excuse to let Boston College into the field somehow?
At what cost? I like the only scenario I could somehow endorse it is if it's something where like flu season hits in a month and half the teams are just like sick in the hospital and the NCAA is like, look, we got to push this back 3 months. But rather than have a season starting on Valentine's Day, we're just going to have like a couple exhibition games in February and then March. We're not going to do conference tourneys. We're just going to put every team in the pot because we're going to see what happens, and they have, this is their only chance to play. And if you don't think that America would go nuts if Dixie State and Duke are tied at halftime, you're crazy.
Dixie State and Duke would not be tied.
I gotta say that, but wouldn't still make more sense even in that case to say, not let's not have conference tournaments, but let's have conference tournaments because we really have had a 358-team tournament for the, with the national championship for years. That's what the conference tournaments have been.
That's what the survival board is. Look at the survival board.
Every conference has a tournament. I mean, sure, like maybe the Ivy League only lets half the field in, but most conferences let the entire conference into the conference tournament too. It is a chance for Dixie State to go winless in the regular season and still win the national championship, in theory.
Yeah.
I'm not opposed to conference tourneys if we can make them work, so
okay.
Second the motion.
I would – how about this for a format? And let me start with this. I want to make it clear that I do not like this. I just dislike it a lot less. If we were to have conference tournaments and the winners went right into the round of 64, so 32 of the 64 are determined by the conference tournament winners, and the other – what is that, 320, 330 that didn't win conference tournaments play their way into the final 32 spots, I would be – a little more warmed up to that than just straight up 357. Let's just bracket the whole thing.
I see what you mean there. So you're getting 30, you're chewing up 32 spots for, I'm sorry, 22 spots for the smaller conferences guaranteed.
Yeah.
Plus 10 automatic bids from the large 10 major power conferences. Yeah. But one more topic I wanted to hit on tonight, and David, let me kind of stick with you here for this, because I know this is a topic that's kind of big, so that you've wanted the NCAA to do for a while. They pushed back the start of the basketball season. As a result, there will be no conflict between Election Day this year and the in college basketball games. But the NCAA went one step further with regard to getting students out there to vote.
This is actually a really good story. It happened unbelievably quickly. The Student Athlete Activity Council, I believe that's how what it stands for. But anyway, had the national organ. I mean, essentially, this is the student athlete's seat at the table with the NCAA, and it's all college athletics, not just basketball. Came forth with the proposal of basically turning election day, not just the presidential elections, but every 2 years into a dead day, meaning no travel, you have to be on campus, no practice, and no competition, obviously. And amazingly, upon getting the proposal, the NCAA approved it on site. I couldn't believe it.
It's great. And then schools such as Georgia, really got to give a shout out to them. They turned around then and decided that there would be no voting sites available on campus anyway. Right, yeah. You have to go into town if you want to vote.
But if you worked in athletics.
So shout out to the University of Georgia for making sure that their students can't vote, you know.
And we've been around athletics, and you know this. You don't – I mean, a lot of people didn't register to vote. And we're almost encouraged not to, not because you didn't want to or that it was political. It was because you didn't want it to disrupt what you were doing. You didn't want to be picked for jury duty. You couldn't vote anyway because if you were playing or traveling, you wouldn't be able to. People from out of state. I mean, so there just was never, ever, ever a push to get student athletes or really even employees to vote. And now it's a dead day. Like, you're not doing anything that day. So I think this is – at a time when everybody is really beating up the NCAA, and understandably so, this was something that the student athletes said they wanted, and the NCAA said, yes, you can have it. I thought it was great.
Well, every now and then the NCAA does something right. I guess that was kind of like the clock is clock is right twice a day. But on that note, though, that's all the topics I had here. So I just kind of run through each of you for any of the final thoughts or anything else you want to bring up for the evening. Sleeka, let me start with you.
Well, we had talked earlier about some games that are going to be played in these bubbles or controlled environments. I mean, one example is going to be the preseason tournaments like the Battle for Atlantis / South Dakota. Another one's going to be Maui. But you're also going to look for series like the Big 12, the Big East, and as well as the Gavin Tip-Off games that are hopefully going to be coming a little more of a priority as the Big 10 tries to get back into the athletic calendar themselves, because I think they're supposed to be resuming football as of mid or late October. So at least there is going to be a renewed sense of optimism that even if we don't get the full non-conference schedule plus whatever the conference schedule will be, we'll still get to at least see some marquee matchups, even if there's not, let's say, under the radar versus major teams, but still FCS conferences versus other majors.
Yeah, I have heard that the ACC Big Ten challenge is a priority. It's going to happen. The SEC Big 12, I believe, is going to happen. And in January, what it has happened the last few years, I've heard both of those seem to be definitely going to be on. So that is good news in terms of those events. Haven't heard anything about a 24-hour hoops marathon for opening day, which would be great because you got a lot of games to get in.
Yeah.
Tytel, how about you?
A little disturbed early this week to see that Texas State coach Danny Caspar resigned amid allegations of racist and or insensitive comments or behavior. Disturbed both the fact that if he indeed did what he's accused of doing, that's terrible. But the fact that in this day and age in 2020, where we're trying to end systemic racism and everybody is supporting in the NBA bubble, like Black Lives Matter on the court, and a lot of the college teams are getting into it. It's sad that there's still this kind of stuff going on. Kudos that we can nip it in the bud, even if it was 3 months after the initial allegations in June. Hopefully they can get a new coach to come in and get the program back on track. But Sad to see that in 2020 stuff like this is still happening.
Not just the NBA title, but I've heard that Big East teams are also going to be wearing the Black Lives Matter patches, all 10 of them, or all 11 of them this year. This is what happens when you add UConn to the mix.
Yeah. All this is going on, and on top of that, we've got to put UConn in the Big East. Come on, guys. Go back to your American conference where you belong. Nobody cares about you. David, you want to finish off the show for us tonight?
Yeah, to kind of go along with that, it's just been, and nobody needs me to tell them this, it's just been a crazy, terrible, awful time pretty much since March. We had the NCAA tournament canceled amidst unbelievable storylines of teams like Dayton and San Diego State and Florida State, Gonzaga, who is normally good, but still to have that many teams.
Rutgers.
Rutgers, another good one. But to have basically three teams in the top five that were not power conference teams and another in Florida State that, while a power conference team, was not a blue blood, I think that the storylines were incredible. And you kind of hated that you missed that. And while basketball, it looks like it will be back, we don't know exactly what it will look like, what it will feel like, or how it will ultimately play out, or if it will be able to play out. I think that it will. But I just still feel really bad for the players, the coaches, I mean, for the fans as well, but for the student athletes, you want them to be able to experience what college basketball is. And I don't know if it will be that way this year. I don't know if it'll feel that way. I think it will again someday, but maybe not this year. On top of that, it is a crazy time to be a student. Of any kind, but particularly a student athlete. You have to wear masks everywhere. A lot of people are under strict protocols where maybe you're in serious trouble for having people over into your room. College, like, it comes from the Latin. I think it literally means to collect. It's the whole point of it is the opposite of social distancing, yet that's what we're having to do. So they're kind of being robbed of the college experience as well as the athlete experience. And then on top of that, we're kind of living in the world that John Tytel mentioned with the social justice movements, where there's been a lot of pushback. And I kind of don't get it. I mean, a year ago when we saw these videos of passengers being dragged off airlines, everyone was mad, but they don't understand why a lot of, you know, the Black community and student athletes in particular are upset when they see police brutality. I mean, some of the reactions to them basically just expressing their own frustration and not doing anything more than that have been terrible. And it's kind of upsetting when you're on Twitter or on social media and you see that kind of backlash or response. Part of me just wants to say, you know what, if that's how you feel, don't watch anymore. We won't miss you. But I hope we have basketball this year. I hope it's a good – I think we will. But on top of that, I hope that for the students and for the players and for us, and especially for myself, that it feels like the way college basketball is supposed to.
Well, I guess on that note, I do want to thank everybody for having joined us tonight. Quick housekeeping matter. If those have followed us for years now, this was normally our last off-season podcast. When we came back in October, we were doing preseason predictions. We are actually going to have a regular off-season October show for the first time ever.
First
next
time
month.
Ever, yes.
Then we will start doing our preseason shows sometime in probably in the middle of early middle of November before we get up to our November 25th. Thanksgiving start of the entire college basketball season. But on that note, I do want to thank everybody for joining us. On behalf of John Stalica down there, who's still defunding Kyle Lamb, John Tytel, David Griggs over here, I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again real soon.